Good morning, I'm Andrea Wilhelm, your session chair. Before we start, could I please ask you to make sure your cell phones are off or in silent mode? And after the talk, please do use the microphones to ask questions so that everyone can hear. And it is now my great pleasure to introduce Toshihide Nakayama and Tsuyoshi Ono, who will be talking about language documentation when the community is not in the mood.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. My co-presenter, Tsuyoshi Ono, cannot be here, so I'm just sort of speaking on our behalf. And thank you for coming, and this sounds like an airline announcement, but I realize you had other choices, and I appreciate that you come to this one. Okay, our talk is about a bit of frustration that we have been feeling in our documentation work in the Ikema community, which is in Miyako Island, Okinawa, Japan. And from an early stage of our work, we were conscious of the community-centered approach to documentation and were trying to make our research useful to the community. But it has been rather difficult to make this approach work in our setting. Okay, by way of sort of background, let me first quickly talk about the recent trend in language documentation methodology. From the very beginning, language documentation research was concerned about the needs of the community, but recently there is a push toward the model with the community playing increasingly greater and more active role in documentation work. Community-centered collaboration gets often talked about as part of the best practice in language documentation. Also, the merits of research projects are often evaluated and commented upon from the perspective of increased community involvement and collaboration. And this emphasis makes sense now that researchers are trying to think harder about how we can make our work relevant and useful to revitalization efforts in the community. The issue we are facing in Ikema is sort of general lack of awareness. And the community does not seem to see the decline of the traditional language as a social problem. We have done sort of interview-based survey, and there, even though people are aware of the decline, they see it simply as part of sort of old thing getting obsolete and lost, making way for new things. So they would say, it's something that cannot be helped. So the wishes and needs of the community with regard to the future of their languages are not sort of clear. But the community-centered approach presupposes a community with clear needs and wishes about their language. So, what should we do? In other words, how should we proceed when a community is not in the mood for revitalization? And we wish we had an answer to give you, but we don't. And instead, sort of, we wanted to hear from you if you know the answer, and if you don't know the answer, it might be sort of worthwhile to sort of think about it together. Okay, so here's how my talk is organized. First, I'll give you some basic information about Ikema language and also historical social context surrounding the language, and I'll also talk about endangerment situation and attitude toward the language, and also factors shaping the situation. And finally, we'll have a bit of discussion. Okay, first, let me show you the location of Ikema in the map. So as I said earlier, Ikema is in Okinawa region. So this is a map of sort of Japan. And Okinawan islands are located southwest of the mainland Japan. And Miyako Island, within this Okinawan islands, Miyako Island is located about 170 miles southwest of main Okinawa Island and just 180 miles northeast of Taiwan. So it's so located in the midpoint between mainland Okinawa and Taiwan. And Ikema Island is located north of Miyako Island. It used to be just there was no sort of way to get to the island without a boat. But now they built the bridge between mainland sort of Miyako and Ikema. Okay, linguistically, Ikema belongs to the Japonic family. Ryukyuan languages together with Japanese form Japonic, and Ryukyuan separated from Japanese by around like 6th century or earlier even. And after that, Ryukyuan and Japanese developed independently for about 1,000 years without much contact. And Ryukyuan and Japanese are not mutually intelligible currently. So it can really make sense if they talk in their own language. And this Ryukyuan group is divided into two major branches, southern group, northern group, and southern group. And Ikema is a dialect of Miyako, which belongs to the southern group. Okay. Next, let me give you a brief sort of a bit of a historical background. Miyako was part of Ryukyu Kingdom. This kingdom was a politically independent nation consisting of hundreds of islands between Taiwan and Kyushu Island of Japan. And kingdom had very active trading relationship with China and had very strong social-cultural influences from them. But in early 17th century, the kingdom was invaded by Satsuma clan of Kyushu, backed by Japanese government, and has had an intense contact with Japan since then. And in late 19th century, the kingdom was officially annexed to Japan. And under the Japanese government's assimilation policy, Ryukyuan culture and language were more or less completely suppressed. And after that, after World War II, Okinawan islands were under U.S. occupation until 1970s. And oppression against the traditional language started as part of assimilation policy and continued as part of standardization of Japanese as a sort of a national language in connection to the modernization of Japan. And one of the example is the Hogenfuda that's on the picture shown there. That translate as dialect placard, sort of a device that was used at school, mostly in elementary schools, in order to discourage the use of vernacular language, which was designated as Hogen. Hogen is a dialect. And at that time, use of local language was strictly forbidden at school, and when students slipped into vernacular language, they were forced to wear this wooden tag, saying "Hōgen Fuda," that's a dialect placard, or "Hōgen Shiyōsha," that's dialect user. And sort of clever thing is they cannot get rid of that tag until they find someone else who is speaking dialect. So someone, sometimes there was a sort of play, they sort of trick on someone, a fellow student to talk in sort of a dialect, then sort of, you can get rid of that tag. But anyway, as a result of this, use of Ikema along with other Okinawan languages were strongly stigmatized. And about endangerment situation, Miyako is among four Ryukyuan languages classified as definitely endangered in the UNESCO's Atlas of the World Languages in Danger. And children no longer learn the language as mother tongue in their homes. And it has been estimated that there are only 2,000 to 3,000 fluent speakers, but there are no monolingual speakers of Ikema. And generally speaking, it is rare to find fluent Ikema speakers below the age of 55. And Ikema speakers are constantly exposed to Japanese through mass media and also contact with children who don't speak Ikema. Okay. And now let me turn to attitudes toward their language and its environment. Recently, there are growing interest in regional cultures and languages all across Japan, not only Okinawan islands, but the main and in that sort of development, the main island of Okinawa in particular is receiving a lot of attention and also like a tourism from outside. And same thing is happening in Miyako, although to a much smaller degree. So you start seeing like speech competitions and school plays in the traditional languages, and also use of the traditional language in tourism promotions and so on. But this surge of interest has not necessarily led to increase in daily use of the language. And so in a way, sort of traditional language is something interesting to look or hear, but not to use. Okay. Okay. And there is also, it is also rare to find people with focused concern about language. So there are people who feel sad about the decline of the traditional language in connection to the loss of old ways in general, but it's sort of rare to find people who feel strongly about the issue of language loss in particular. And there is also a wide variation in attitude toward the language. And as for the status of Ikema in relation to Japanese, the sense of the sort of community member is Japanese is the official formal language, and whereas Ikema is just a dialect of Japanese. So what that means is Ikema is sort of part of Japanese or a kind of Japanese, and even some native speaker, there are native speaker linguists of Okinawan languages, but some of these linguists even strongly argues that Okinawan language be considered dialects instead of separate language. And also Ikema is not a full-fledged language, and Ikema is just an informal variety, or informal or vulgar variety of Japanese spoken by maybe older people. Interestingly, the choice of language between Ikema and Japanese seems to be connected more closely to the contextual style rather than social identity. So Ikema speakers choose to speak Japanese simply because it is contextually appropriate to do so. So when we, you know, go there, they talk to us, of course, in, you know, like a standard Japanese. And of course, partly because, you know, we don't have full command of dialects, but even we get better at speaking in sort of dialects, they still sort of, it's sort of harder for them to keep talking in dialects because it's not sort of appropriate, you know, when you talk to sort of, you are in a sort of formal situation talking to, you know, outsiders. So speaking Japanese does not necessarily constitute conflict with or negation of their social identity as Ikema people. And regarding the fact that the traditional language is getting lost, there isn't much sort of a strong concern about the situation in the community. So there is not much interest in the current state or future of the language. And as a result, there is not much interest in recording or preservation of the traditional language. And of course, but this does not, you know, mean, you know, community members are hostile against, you know, documentation work. They are in fact very helpful and cooperative, but they seem to be helping out of social obligation rather than enthusiasm. So community members feel obligated to assist, you know, professors who come all the way to do some important work. So community members themselves don't seem to know what they want for their language. So as a result, language documentation work is perceived as researchers' agenda, not theirs. So they cooperate, but it's not, you know, it's not something they would be interested in. And as you can see, the situation is quite different from the model cases in North America or Australia. And the question is, why is this the case? And it seems that this has to do with two related reasons. One is, Generally, Ikema speakers do not have a strong desire for an independent social-cultural identity. So Ikema community members are happy to be, or sometimes even afraid not to be, part of Japan. And this may have to do with the fear of sort of marginalization or discrimination, you know, resulting from sort of separation. And they don't have a strong interest in their language as a basis for their cultural identity. And of course, this is partly because they are not particularly interested in the independent identity, and also partly because they don't think of their language as a sort of separate language. They, as I said, you know, they consider it as just a variety of Japanese. So the speakers do not have a strong motivation to use Ikema in connection to display or strengthening of identity. And this situation, of course, does not help speakers getting sort of motivated to expand or even keep their language use of Ikema. And this type of situation where speakers and communities as a whole are not interested in language or maintenance of language very much is not necessarily unique. And actually, among other things, Land Forget 1992 reports a similar situation in some parts of Africa, for example. And so not all communities develop a strong interest in preservation and revitalization of the traditional language, and people do not necessarily take special interest in languages separately from the rest of the culture. So this is the situation we have, and the question we have been wondering and debating about are the following. So should we problematize the endangerment for the community when they don't seem to care so much? How can we be sensitive to the needs of the community when the community is not aware of them or when they don't have them? Whose needs should we cater to when the attitude of the community is kind of varied? So one could argue, this is a sort of special case because Ikema is an endangered language. Because Ikema is an endangered language, maybe we should be more proactive. Maybe we should try to raise people's awareness about the danger. Maybe we should take aggressive steps to preserve and revitalize the language. After all, it will be a loss that will affect not just the current generation, but also the future generations and the humanities in general. But of course, tricky thing is language revitalization requires a conscious changes of everyday habits and social attitude among the community members. And also, it is difficult to maintain the momentum without strong internal motivations and desires. So, our current thinking is, we should be open to and ready for requests from the community or speakers for help. And let's hope that our interest in their language stimulate interest and a sense of pride among the community members about their language. But we are not sure if we should or could tell people how they should feel about their language. And when we reached these tentative conclusions, we felt kind of stupid because, they all seem commonsensical. But then the question is, how did we get into this discussion in the first place? And we sort of, when we look back, we felt kind of stuck in a way, or trapped. And we felt, we should be working with the community, with and for the community, but we couldn't know how. So that feeling was making us sort of frustrated. And why then, of course, did we feel frustrated? And we realized that we were sort of trapped by the sense of guilt. Guilt of failing to bring enough benefit to the community. And this sense of guilt is triggered by the sort of mismatch between the situation we are in and our idea of the best practice formed around the model of community-centered collaboration. And we had built our expectations and the notion of best practice on the basis of, model cases from other areas, particularly from, North America and Australia. And, we are sort of trying hard to do the right thing for the community, but we were ending up sort of discouraging ourselves. So we realized that, trying too hard to follow the best practice can be counterproductive sometimes. So in conclusion, we figured, you know, we need to be aware of diversity among the situations surrounding endangered languages. In some situations, community centers collaboration model may not work well. And of course, you know, needless to say, it is not our intention to argue against the community centered collaboration model, but it is important at the same time to remember that, you know, best practice is a guide and not a rule. And original, you know, discussion of the best practice was probably intended as a sort of guide rather than rule or a standard. But of course, once it's there, sort of it tends to start looking like a rule and a standard. And you know, language documentation is hard work, and it will be sort of important to not to sort of discourage yourself or, you know, others just because we can't follow the best practice. And that's what we thought anyway. And we hope this report of our experience is useful for some of you at least. Thank you.
The bulk of my work over the last 10 years has been heavily impacted by the exact same problem, that the community is not the one coming up with requests or initiatives and so on, and so I find myself in the same situation as you. The approach I have taken, I figured I should share it, is that there's a paper by Leboeuf where he talks about the Ann Arbor case, and something, and it's a very well-cited paper, and I cannot remember the exact year. But one of the points that is rarely talked about in that paper is his recommendation or directive that we have the responsibility to share our research with the parties affected by the results. And so I've taken that very seriously, more so than best practices, because in fact, best practices, as they appear in the literature, not only want us to move in a direction, but they discourage us from even trying to think about revitalization if the community is not engaged. But if your research is telling you that the language is going to disappear, which is the situation where I am, there are very invisible and tangible signs of significant risk for the language. These are signs that are invisible largely to the community, but I'm seeing them very easily in my research. So I feel compelled to share that. I wanted to ask you how long you've been working with this community. I've been working with this transnational community in Oaxaca and LA for 10 years, and it's only now in the last 3 weeks that I have been able to identify a number of people in the Los Angeles transnational diaspora community that I think can be part of that collaboration that I've been seeking. But it's taken me 10 years, and it just happened. I think the lesson that I've taken from my experience is that while certainly a revitalization program is not going to work without the engagement of the community, we do have this responsibility to share our research, and maybe that sharing process can engage the right people.
All right. Yeah.
I would like to know how long you've been working.
My collaborator, the Tsuyoshi Ono, was the sort of one main sort of started earlier, much earlier, and he has been working with the community for about 5 years, and I have been sort of joining him for the last 2 years, so I guess we have like 5 to 8 years to sort of find out about the.
Maybe it'll go faster.
Right. But I have been working with other community in Nuchan in British Columbia, and with that community, I've been working with them for close to 20 years. But And the situation was quite different because they were eager to, you know, they had their agenda and they were eager to do something about their language. So in that comparison too sort of made me kind of frustrated because they are so different. Maybe back.
First off, domo arigato gozaimasu. I'm very curious, you said, you know, a few years here and there. I know it takes a while sometimes to really get into a community and to create that sense of ease where listeners and speakers can give the back and forth.
Sure.
We just came from a panel recently, the previous one, about sociolinguistic methods and perhaps doing more ethnography. And I was wondering if there have been also attempts to do this type of research, because I found that in trying to maybe study even regional dialects near Tokyo, it wasn't until, especially the older generation that I was with, had a few beers, we had sat down and, you know, done this ritual for a while, that it became okay to start talking. And I really only found it if I became invisible and got as many people as I could in one room. Mm-hmm. And then I started seeing things, and I started being able to, with permission, document or to record things, and that was okay. So how many people have you gotten into a room? What's the average age, and are there hobbies maybe that you haven't pursued with these people that could maybe unlock some more of that language?
Right. One of the sort of great people places we have been working in is a sort of a daycare place for elderly people. So, and there you see people around like 80s, even some 90s. And that's a great place because they don't move around much, but they have tons of stuff to talk about. So it's been great. And Tsuyoshi Ono, he has been really good with sort of making connections and sort of making people at ease. And also we have to drink a lot because, you know, from Okinawa is known for like really good and strong alcohol. So you gotta be sort of ready for it in a way. But so it took a while, of course, you know, for us to build that kind of relationship. But now we are sort of in that mode where, you know, if we sort of keep our mouths shut, people will not notice us. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering if you've ever had the opportunity to bring members from the community to a workshop or to a conference where there are other language communities present. Because in my experience, we've run language documentation workshops in the North Caucasus, and when some of the community members came out and saw other language communities, they suddenly got very excited, mm-hmm. and they were finding out little projects that were being done. I mean, there's kind of a healthy competition, that's one aspect, right. But there's just the psychological aspect of someone else being excited about it, suddenly you want it too,
mm-hmm.
and it raises a, right. you know, a new appreciation
and
awareness.
Point.
I'm wondering if you had
right.
have the opportunity to do something like that.
Well, short answer is no. The thing is, that type of thing, like a workshop focused on like a, you know, endangered languages and so on, is not happening in Japan because in general, sort of a realization, awareness of language loss and the endangerment is sort of, I wouldn't say non-existent, but really close to non-existent. So, I mean, we are trying to raise awareness among linguists now about the problem. And of course, they know the term, you know, language endangerment, but they don't think of that as a sort of a domestic thing. You know, it's a sort of some international thing that's happening in North America or Australia or some other. And also the fact that these languages in Okinawa has been long considered as dialects by mainland people and also, you know, like Okinawans themselves are not helping because they are not aware of that sort of a problem as a matter of endangerment of language. It's just endangerment of, you know, like old ways. So.
Thanks for your talk. I think the issues that you're talking about are very similar to a lot of themes that have come up during this conference. I know Laura Robinson has done some lovely quantification of this issue, and we talked about a similar thing on Friday.
Yeah.
I was wondering, something that I've been thinking about is, did you have particular collaborative goals in mind, or was it kind of like, I'll go there, we'll become like really thick, and then they'll come to me with collaboration? Because one thing I found is that in order to make anything resembling collaboration work, it actually has to be a lot more structured. And so instead of waiting for people to approach me with ideas, I'll kind of bring an activity and I will kind of generate the collaboration myself if I want. So I was wondering if you had any particular collaborative goals in mind and how you might think about making them happen.
Right. Well, the main thing, two things is, you know, one is sort of recording, making recording of traditional, like plays or, you know, oral literature or not oral literature, but oral performances and so on, and also making a dictionary. But sort of, I guess we're always sort of in this bind, you know, we want to be sort of suggesting possible ways we can deal with this, but at the same time we were always sort of a little, you know, we have a little voice saying, you know, maybe we are imposing our own agenda, and sort of we are sometimes or many times sort of feel shy about sort of, you know, suggesting too much, and we can sort of easily sort of discouraged by sort of not getting enough, you know, attention or maybe interest when we make suggestions. So, you know, we try different things, but we haven't been able to find the really like a good button to push. So that's where we stand.
Thank you very much. That's all the time we have for questions. Let's thank our speaker.
That was very helpful. Thank you.